probably is not joining us right at the beginning. She's later on in the agenda. So I'll confirm.
Okay, good.
Well, I guess it's time to get started. We good to go, Tracy?
We are.
Okay. Thank you so much to everyone who is here with us. We appreciate it. It's great to be back together and have the Welfare Reform Commission together here in sunny St. George. We appreciate Representative Snow for ordering up the weather for us. It was great. We were able to go run outside this morning and
good.
Knock on the treadmill, which would be very
good.
Really appreciate that. I've got over a foot of snow in my house. So. And we welcome those who are joining us remotely.
Mary, can you hear us?
Anne, can you hear us?
Or Anne, sorry.
It's a little disjointed. Proceed. I can understand. Thank you, listening.
Maybe we'll speak a little slower.
You sound great, so we can hear you. Thank you. We have Bishop Burton, who is on the audio call with us as well. Welcome, Bishop Burton.
Yeah. Okay. Good morning, all.
We're glad to have you. Let's go ahead and get started with the with agenda item number one. We have the approval of the November 14th, 2018 Joint Commission and Advisory Meeting minutes. If there's no changes, I'd look for a motion to approve.
I move to approve minutes.
Thank you. I have a motion. Is there a second?
Okay.
A motion, a second. All in favor, please say aye.
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 And any opposed? Right, the motion carries unanimously. As we talked in our last meeting, we have a vacancy in the with the focus on childhood poverty. As an executive team, Bishop Burton and I and staff have gone over and we had a couple of resumes. We are recommending the appointment of Jennifer Godfrey with the Utah Community Action. She is the Chief Executive Officer and CEO and the Director of Head Start. I think most of you are aware of those great organizations and the good things that are happening there. Utah Community Action provides the direct services to children in poverty and their parents. So really close relationship with the very citizens of our state that we're concerned about and working with. Anything to add, John or Tracy or Bishop Burton?
I just would add that as a direct service provider, it's a unique opportunity to make sure that that perspective is there.
Okay. All right, I agree, Bishop Burton. She's got a great resume, and I know you've all had a chance to look at that. If that's acceptable to the commission, we would entertain a motion there as well.
I would so move.
Thank you.
I will second it.
Thank you. We have a motion and a second. Thanks, Dr. Miner. Any further discussion? All right. Seeing none, all in favor, please say aye.
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 And any opposed? Okay.
I do have a question. Please. Is this Head Start program Salt Lake County wide?
Salt Lake and Tooele. It goes as far west as Wendover, actually.
I just wondered if there was more than one Head Start. They're
the biggest Head Start provider in the state.
Yes, for sure.
All right, thank you. Okay, moving right along. Item three is we're going to talk about our annual report. John, I know you're going to provide some background there for us.
So we're interested in doing a little deeper research for this upcoming report. And we've been talking about this internally and have brought the proposal to the Lieutenant Governor, which she supports. So we just want to make sure that all the agency heads that are on the commission understand what the roles and responsibilities will be moving forward. We're hoping that this approach will get us more aligned with reaching the goals of the commission and so forth. So Carrie and Tracy are going to give you an overview of what we're proposing and what that would mean to your data folks and you as department heads. So see it up like that. You guys take it from there.
Sure. Yeah, so as all the agencies know, we've been doing this comprehensive data analysis with in partnership with your data folks in looking at all of the areas of child well-being that are the focus of the Intergenerational Poverty Initiative and many indicators within that group. We feel that it's a good opportunity to get a little bit more narrowly focused on those on the research, and actually Carrie's group she'll talk about a little bit more of the details, but actually lock in a group of individuals that we will be able to track over time, and what we will be following up on this meeting on after the discussion is scheduling a meeting with the researchers in each of the agencies. There is a research subcommittee that we've been communicating a lot via email because we've had the approach so well dialed in over the past few years. But we're going to reconvene and approach it a little bit differently with the agencies. So I'll have Carrie explain high level what the approach is, and then talk about next steps and what we're hoping the agencies will provide going forward.
So what we've done thus far is, as you probably all are aware, each time we produce a report, we take a look at last year's IGP picture. So every year we take a new picture, and it's a new set of individuals, and it gives us an idea of the breadth of IGP across our different agencies. What it didn't allow us to do is a longitudinal time series type analysis, because every time we took a new picture, it was technically a new group of people, and therefore we weren't really tracking an individual, we were tracking the concept. So what we're trying to do now is track the individuals. So what we want to do, we're going to go back to an earlier year, I believe we're going for 2013, grab that cohort and stay with those individuals. Don't reassess the cohort every year, but rather take those individuals and look at their public assistance usage up until our most recent data. So then we can really do longitudinal trend analysis. What we would like to do is for each agency, we will provide that cohort and empower the individual agencies to do their own longitudinal analysis. What we would like to do is create a template of broad concepts we'd like everyone to hit so that there's consistency, and when Tracy puts the report together in the end, it can flow well and really narrate a message. But the template will be very broad in that the agencies will be empowered to look at trends in whatever arenas they feel are important relative to how they touch the IGP individuals. So for DWS, for example, the economists in my shop will be doing econometric analysis to see how economic trends play out with these particular IGP individuals. So if the economy is trending upward, do the IGP individuals feel that upward benefit, or are they missing out on that upward benefit? We're going to be looking at their employment. We're going to be looking at their wages. We'll be looking at the consistency of their attachment. And we're going to, because we'll be doing econometric analysis, we'll be able to control for any other outside variables that affect their economic performance and really dial into how DWS is affecting their economic performance. So when we meet with all of the researchers, we'll present to them what we're doing as our approach as an idea or a suggestion for them to pursue their own. But we'll be working with the individuals and we'll be working with them to pass over that cohort and strategize on how best to get those agencies to get the data that we need.
Yes, well put. That pretty much sums it up. So in terms of the report, I think the biggest contrast in the past is we gave the data and told, kind of guided you exactly on the analysis that we wanted. Now we're kind of giving you the cohort and letting each of the agency run their own analysis so that as a department you will have the ability to determine what policies, programs, rule changes, coordination needs to occur given your particular programs. And then that would make up the construct of the product of the annual report. And in terms of the online data dashboards, it will also be adjusted so it's tracking this cohort over time, and we'll be able to measure that. So any programmatic changes or rule changes that you all put in place as a result of the data, we will actually be able to measure impact and outcome. So that's it. Next steps, we have a meeting at the end of January, I think in 2 weeks, with the research subcommittee. We're hoping that will also include your policy folks, not just the data researchers, so that they have the ability and knowledge base to take the data and be part of the policy and programmatic and rule change discussions. And happy to answer any questions, concerns.
I'm really excited about this. Thanks to all of you. Carrie, thank you so much for your direction on this as well. This is helpful. I think this is what we really want to see and interested in. So thank you. Questions that anyone has for DWS? Dr. Meyer?
Will we have health indicator data on the same individuals? This one.
So I think the process would be very similar to what we've done before. If we give you the individuals, and your staff would take that those SSNs and pull in to your own data all those health indicators. So that process is very similar to what we've done before. But instead of just looking at pulling in 1 year, they could pull the whole time period
over
right.
5 years through 17.
Mm-hmm.
That way.
Yep. Uh-huh. Yep. And then look at the trends for that one group.
I think because it took us a couple of years to actually settle and agree to all the indicators as a commission. I think what we will do is still look at those indicators, because those were the lead indicators that as a commission we agreed to with the 5-year and 10-year goals. But that will not limit the any further analysis that your department will want to do and look at with respect to these individuals.
Excellent. Okay. Any other questions? Okay. All right. Notice Representative Thurston joined us on the video call. Welcome. We're glad to have you, and we'll be getting you a little further along on the agenda.
Thank you.
Hey, I was just going to say, for those of you on the video calls, if you can mute on your end, the microphones are pretty sensitive, so just mute until time and until you want to speak. So, okay, great. Let's move on. We're very excited to have Representative Snow and Kim Cordova here with us. Thanks to both of them for taking time. We've asked them to come and provide an update on juvenile justice reform. Again, something very near and dear to us on this commission, and we're excited to hear from you. So welcome, and thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you all for giving me an opportunity, and Kim Cordova. Most of you know Kim. She is our director of our Commission on Criminal and Juvenile Justice, and is doing an outstanding job and is very involved in the juvenile justice reform. She sits as a member of the committee, but also helps head up much of the implementation. So we're going to turn some time to her as well as part of the presentation. So getting to the presentation, do one of you have PowerPoint? If you could help me maybe cue that up. And while we're getting to that, some of you may wonder, why are we discussing this as part of intergenerational poverty? The one thing I think you'll all agree with me that we're learning is how we treat children, whether it's in a school experience, whether it's at home and when it's in the criminal justice system, how we're treating our children in the juvenile justice system to a large major depends or has an effect on how they succeed in adulthood. And that's what the study and evidence and data shows us. And there is a connection between the outcomes of children in our juvenile justice system and ultimately their success, not only as a student, but also in a career. So as soon as we get this first slide up, I'm going to tell you about a study group that was commissioned by the leadership of our state back in 2016. Let's see if we can. Like we're getting it. There we go. Thank you. It's nice to start with the Great Seal of Utah.
As the keeper of the seal, I approve.
Okay. Thanks, Mr. Lieutenant Governor. All right. So we're going to talk about the policies that have been examined and changes have been made in our state since the study group came about in 2016. Let's go to the next slide. As a result of that study group, there were two significant pieces of legislation, one passed in 2017 and the other one in 132. I was the chief sponsor of both of those, and so my ability to talk about those then and now, I think is appropriate. Let's go to the next slide. As I mentioned, there was the formation of this is a timeline for your give you a roadmap of the working group back in June of 2016. It was commissioned by leadership of the state, including the governor, chief justice of our Supreme Court, leadership of both houses as well. It was to study our system and see if there were improvements that could be made. That group met from June of 2016 to November of 2016. I was part of that group along with three other lawmakers. As a result of that, we made findings and recommendations, and those made their way into HB 239. That was passed in general legislative session in 2017, signed into law in March of 2017. Part of that legislation included the creation of an oversight committee. That was set up and has been running since that period of time. It's staffed by a large group of stakeholders. I think we're up to about 27 or 28 now, from almost every area that may have an interest in the youth in our juvenile justice system. I've been chairing that, and it's been a real honor to do that and travel throughout the state talking to folks and families that are affected by our juvenile justice system. As part of that outreach that occurred in 2017, in 2018, I sponsored modifications to the reform, and that was passed into law earlier this year. And as of July 1st of this year, all policies of the reform are now in effect. Let's go to the next slide. So what did we do? What did the working group do? We looked at data-driven research based on assessment of Utah's juvenile justice system. And we were fortunate in this state to have a lot of data that we could track and follow. And that data provided the backdrop for a lot of the changes that were made. Extensive review of the court and juvenile services data, current research on reducing recidivism, we took that into account. And we conducted roundtables across the state, and I was able to sit in on a number of those in southern Utah. That process, as I mentioned earlier, took about 6 months. Let's go to the next slide. As a result of that, we learned that some principles. We learned that when youth are diverted from a formal court system, the juvenile court system, and from detention, they have better outcomes. And for some people, that may seem counterintuitive. A lot of people think, well, if we really want to get a young person's attention, we run them through the system, we put them in detention, that way they won't come back. And what we found is the data oftentimes shows the counter to that. And there are lots of reasons for that, and I won't get into that because I'm not a psychologist. But we looked at some of the reasons for that, and we also looked at the information dealing with low-risk youth. Those that are ordered to detention on the first case reoffend at higher rates than low-risk youth who don't. So the first indication or the first problem with the juvenile justice system, if they are referred to detention, which was happening in many areas of our state, they reoffend at higher rates. And we also learned that the non-felonies account, that is, the less serious offenses, for most out-of-home placements. You don't find it in there, but one of the things that I heard when I traveled throughout the state is kids would say to me that were in secure detention, if I had access to my family, it would make a difference. And so part of the underlying principle here is we don't take kids out of their home if we can provide them the services, the rehabilitative services in the home. They do better, we get better outcomes, and less recidivism. Let's go to the next one. We also learned about racial disparities occurring, and those disparities were greatest as they progressed through the system. And so the more serious the imposition of a sentence or of a disposition, the greater the disparity. We also saw that there was wide district variation in availability of contracted services while youths were on probation. Obviously, not obvious, but I think to you on this group, there were more services available to the kids in urban areas than in rural areas. But the needs are the same. And in fact, some would argue that some of the needs of those kids living in rural areas are greater than those living in urban areas. We also looked at something that was interesting, that similar recidivism rates for youth released from probation and JJS custody. So you had two different dispositions. Some were in, only had probation. Some were put in secure detention, but recidivism rates were about the same. So what does that mean? Custody costs taxpayers up to 17 more, times more for those secured facilities or kids that stay in those facilities. Next item. So what did we do? We took the data. We came to 55 recommendations. Taken as a package, it does the following. With the reform, prevents deeper system involvement for low-level youth. And I will just tell you that most of the reform focuses on low-level youth. Why? Because if we can intervene at that point and treat them properly, the chances we get better outcomes, the chances will reduce that we're going to see them back in the system, either as a juvenile or as an adult. It frees up resources from the deep end of the system for use in evidence-based early intervention services. So instead of taking low-risk youth and applying a lot of resources for low-risk, if we can preserve those and use them for early intervention, we get better outcomes. Expands access to high-quality services across the state. And that last, or that third one there, relates to legislation that I'm running. It's not on the agenda, but it is to capture the savings that we are realizing in our juvenile justice system, capture them and save them for investment into early intervention, rather than see them dissipated for building roads or something like that. That will be that's my first priority legislation, and I'll make a pitch to you here to look for that. I hope you can support that. It also creates our reform creates statewide standards for implementation and oversight of juvenile justice reform. Okay, next slide. So I'm going to turn some time to Kim, and she's going to tell you about our progress.
Thank you all, and thank you all for having us. We really appreciate the time to be able to come and present and talk to you all. And so as Representative Snow mentioned, you know, the reason that we are so invested in juvenile justice reform is because, of course, the effects on our children. And you know, these eight slides that Representative Snow that went over briefly just kind of gave the points as to what has happened. And so, you know, but of course it was many years and it was many meetings and it was, you know, many, many, many people who've been involved in the research and the preparation and in understanding what was really going on in Utah and then focusing in on the differences geographically, demographically, socioeconomic class, you know, throughout the state, because we understand that there's different needs and there's different resources for different areas across the state and for different demographics. And so we really try to do that, and that's why, you know, I came out here, because I want everyone in the state to know that whatever the issue is, we will go to you. We will give you the resources. We will find the answers. We are there to serve the entire state, not just people like in Salt Lake City or on the Wasatch Front. And so I really appreciate the opportunity to come out here. And so part of what we have done and part of the statute that came out of the legislation was the establishment of the Juvenile Justice Oversight Committee. And on that committee, we have Representative Snow, we have the courts, we have Juvenile Justice Services, and Ann Williamson, who is on this commission, has been instrumental. Juvenile Justice Services has done much of the heavy lifting in these reforms and the implementation of the legislation. Also, the courts have been huge partners, the Board of Education, and also law enforcement with prosecutors and defense attorneys, and our community partners with our mental health professionals and our community activists. We work closely with Voices for Children, the ACLU, and also the YWCA. They've been great partners with us, and so we've really tried to make a deliberate effort to make sure that we connect with all people who are involved and all agencies who are involved in this. Also under, before I forget, that something that ties in a lot to what you all do is also under CCJJ, we have the Indigent Defense Commission. And one of the main bills that's going through this session is to make sure that all children have legal representation when they step into a courtroom. And that isn't the case right now. And so whenever a child is referred to court, they only are assigned representation based on the level of offense. But this, hopefully this new legislation will ensure that every child who touches the courtroom or who goes into the courtroom will have representation and advocacy for them. And that has been, you know, and it goes part and parcel into what we're trying to do and to develop and to these evidence-based practices. And so can you go to the next slide? And so we, like I said, like I was talking about earlier, sometimes we only hear the negatives or the complaints or the concerns when something like this goes through. And, you know, and so what we've really tried to focus on is working with schools and law enforcement and prosecutors about their concerns. And then Representative Snow did an amazing job with that, with adjusting to that from House Bill 239 to House Bill 132, and then also his continuing legislation this year to address the needs and the concerns of the stakeholders that have been involved. And part of that is giving services and making sure that there's implementation on the court side as to what can happen for, let's say, truancy or for these low-level status offenses for these juveniles. Because before, what would happen is that there would be an issue that would happen at school, and the school would punt it to the school resource officer, and they would deal with bad behavior, delinquent behavior, and make it criminal. And so these behaviors, which should have been dealt or should be dealt with in the school setting because they're social issues, like truancy and not coming to school, or tobacco, which is, I think, a health issue, they would kick it to the juvenile courts. And the juvenile courts then, and the research has shown and the data has shown, that the more touches that a juvenile has with juvenile courts, the worse outcomes that they could be. And in rural areas, the data shows that it's more kids of color and more poorer kids who are accelerating through the system at a quicker rate with no representation and for very low-level offenses. We would see kids actually who would go out-of-home placement, and I don't know how much you know about how much that costs, but the custody would be taken from that family. The child would be taken out of the home and placed in either a foster home, a proctor home, a group home, and eventually even into secure care when their offense that got them into the court system was truancy, right? And we know, and the research shows and the data shows, and I know that we say that a lot, but, you know, but it's very, very specific to Utah, and we got the information from the courts and from the schools, from Juvenile Justice Services. And what it showed is that truancy really starts happening at a very young age, right? It doesn't start happening. The problem doesn't happen when they're in 10th or 11th or 12th grade. It usually starts happening when they're in elementary school. And sometimes the reasoning is they have to babysit their little brothers and sisters because mom and dad are at work, or there is no mom and dad, or there's only one parent, and so they have to watch their other siblings. Or they don't have clean clothes, or they're bullied, or there's a second language, and there's language barriers, and there's cultural barriers, and so there's all of these things that we've been criminalizing, what these issues that start at a very young age. And so really, you know, the move forward of getting counselors into the schools, I think, is huge. And shifting the focus of these types of behaviors to more of a social issue, you know, rather than a criminal issue, to give prevention so that these kids don't go further into the system. And so the criticisms that we have encountered, I think, come to that aspect as we're trying to just shift the perspective to do more preventative type of interventions so that we can address the social issues that cause the delinquent behaviors, and that we don't just put these kids on a train that leads them, because before, for many, many years, that's what would happen. They would go to court, they would not comply, they would come back for an order to show cause, they would go to detention. And detention, and really detention and secure care and those types of incarcerated facilities should be focused for more on the public safety issue for the kids who really need to be there. And so what we saw is that you would put a kid in there who was truant with somebody who just shot somebody, right? And what would happen is that the youth who was a serious public safety issue and the kid who was there on a maybe possession or truancy, the kid who was there for a serious wouldn't come down, right? The kid who was there for the low-level offense would rise up. And so then it was very circular and very cyclical, and just the connection and the risk factors would raise on these low-level youth risk factors. And so that's what we're trying to address. And I think that as we go and we talk to law enforcement agencies and we talk to school boards and we talk to the courts and prosecutors and defense attorneys across the state, I think everybody understands that we don't want that to happen. We don't want kids of color to be treated differently. We don't want poor kids to be treated differently. We want them all to be the same, and we certainly don't want kids to go into incarcerated facilities, for things that would raise their risk level on things that they shouldn't have been there. But the problem has been the implementation of that. And again, that cultural shift in how we address these. And of course, a lot of the issues that have been raised are resources, right? As Representative Snow said a little bit, that it costs less for a probation officer from the courts to supervise a youth in their home with their family and their community than it is to take that child out of the home and put it in a Proctor home, because then all of that money, that taxpayer money, is going to the care facilities rather than having the child get into the home and do wraparound services to help the child and the family. And so that's what we're trying to do. And Juvenile Justice Services has been an amazing effort to really reallocate their resources and their distribution of their workforce and their facilities to really put a lot of emphasis on that front-end intervention and to help the schools and help school resource officers to be able to adjust and to deal with this cultural shift. The Board of Education has hired a restorative practices specialist who's going into all of the schools to really help the schools and the local education agencies to implement the restorative practices, because it's not a person. It's not a police officer that's going to change this. It's an effort. It's a cultural shift where everyone has to buy in to hold kids accountable for the behaviors, but do it in a way that they're not accustomed to doing it, and not labeling these kids and not putting them on a path that's going to actually, in the end, hurt them rather than help them or intervene with them. And so we've also are working with the school resource officers and implementing. We have a grant that we're working up talking about disproportionate minority contact, and we have a curriculum that has been developed over the past 3 or 4 years that we're trying to, we're going out and outreaching, and I think that next week is the first training that we're actually going to do with school resource officers to talk about them about implicit bias and about how we, school resource officers, should be a source of resource right, in the school resource officer as rather than the punitive type of person that they have become in the schools. And so we're launching that to train them on disproportionate minority contact. We have a contract with the University of Utah's Justice Resource Center to help us delve into the causes for that and how it comes in, the disproportionate minority contact. Racial disparities in the court system, it exists. It continues to exist. But trying to identify and prevent that and to raise awareness for that is still ongoing. And so we're working with and trying to give the support to our law enforcement agencies. Also, funding, any funding that comes through, a lot of money comes through CCJJ. We don't only do juvenile. We do anything that touches the criminal justice system and adults and juvenile, mental health, substance abuse, sex assault, domestic violence. But we have a lot of federal funding that comes through our office that we are able to assist. For instance, we got a grant that went to juvenile court to help with expungement, right? To help, sometimes the kids will get in trouble when they're 15 for a shoplift or 16 for a shoplift or for an assault and realize they think that goes away when they turn 18, and in fact it doesn't. And so to help, you know, pay for those costs and those fees that are associated with that, and we've gotten judges and the courts and, like I said, all the people who were involved to help that. And we had our first expungement clinic, I think, in October. Do you remember? I think it was in October. And we're going to continue those efforts to try to go again all across the state because it's difficult. We have this one in Ogden, and we had a few people show up, but we're hoping to continue that and to go across the state so that, families and young adults have more access to that. And so I completely went off that, but you guys have the PowerPoint. And so mostly just to let you know that it's continuing ongoing education. We actually were able to also fly in a researcher from California who specializes in adolescent brain development who gave this amazing lecture. We went to Draper, and we went to a school out there, and she was, and Representative Snow was able to get the location for us, but all of the research and the information out there about adolescent brain development is key into how we interact with children. And so we're trying to educate, you know, educators and also law enforcement and judges so that they are able to understand that when a kid says, well, I don't know why I did that, that kid probably really didn't know why they did that, right? And so our efforts are ongoing and they're continuous, and I just want you all to know that we are here as a resource. And if there is something that's going on in your county or in your agency that has anything to do with this, or you're hearing anything through your local law enforcement or through your schools or through your commissioners, that we are here as a place of resource and that we will come to wherever you are to help and assist and give you, make those connections for you all. So that's all. Thank you.
Would you mind if we just... next slide shows...
Oh, sorry.
No, it's okay. I just want you to know some of the progress that's being made. So some might think referrals to juvenile court being down maybe shows inattention to what's happening. And the reality is a recognition that schools and others are saying, in this case, with this kind of behavior, let's deal with it here rather than put that child into the court system, because now we know what the data shows us and what the outcomes are. And so we are doing better. But this is not only a big lift, but it's a sustained lift, and it's long term. Admissions to locked detentions continue to climb and are down 44% since 16. And so what does that mean? That means more children at home. That means more children's families. That means more families accessing wraparound services. And ultimately, we're going to, long run, have better outcomes. But it has been a cultural shift, especially for the schools, because they have been, as Kim mentioned, the default has been, if someone is truant, if someone is caught doing one of these things, I don't want to say the easiest thing, but it really was the easiest thing, is refer them to court. And let's let them deal with it. After all, it's breaking the law, and therefore, that's who is best able to deal with it. But we're changing that paradigm, but it's an ongoing process. So anyway, I didn't mean to ramble too, but if you have questions, we're committed. I know Kim and I both are committed to the long haul on this and to doing the outreach, and that's why we're both here.
I do have a question, and Lowry, maybe you can update us. As you had mentioned, Kim, one of the struggles for high schools was we're not going to refer, we're going to keep them, but they don't have the resources internally, which was the biggest, I think, right, sticking point that first year. Has that changed, or how has that changed? Were they given additional resources to deal with them internally? Or?
You want to touch on that?
Yes, and so they have. And so in working with the State Board of Education, let me get to that PowerPoint. Okay. And so, what the school, so under Rule 277-607, right, so the schools have always been required and have always had the obligation and the responsibility to address truancy there. And so these rules didn't change. And then there was some money. Okay, so is it yours? Enhancement for at-risk students? And so now that can be used for truancy.
Oh, so they did change that. Okay. Now I'll be talking about increases to that funding at the end of the meeting. So
that was part of House Bill 132.
From last year.
We changed that to enlarge access to those funds to support that. Yeah. Okay.
And then also the hiring of the restorative practice specialist, mm-hmm. I think her name is Gail Threet. Mm-hmm. And so she has also been a great resource in that implementation. And so part of that money through the years is that they are able to hire somebody or to just implement those practices and to train their staff. Also, funding can come through us. And so we do have a federal grant that we're trying to implement right now where we have hired and vetted independent agencies who specialize in restorative practices. And so we understand, and this has been an education for me as well, from the Board of Education to the LEAs and how that all transfers. And so we've been working with the Board of Education, but also we need to work more with the LEAs.
Right.
And so to get resources and that and those connections into more of the LEAs while the Board of Education is working on the top end, mm-hmm. we're trying to get resources and grants to connect LEAs on the bottom end to be able to implement the restorative justice practices.
Thank you.
Let me add to that, too. And Anne, I hope Anne is still with us. Anne has worked overtime to provide better services throughout the state. And I just want to give tribute to you, Anne, for your help on this, because that, in turn, has helped schools and helped families. The way we view this issue is we think of these silos. This is the court, this is the schools, this is mental health services, and we have to break down some of those, and we're seeing this happen. And Anne helped lead the way with an MOU that was historic between her department and the courts to make services concentrate on families and young people and figure out how do we get the services without worrying about too much about where it's coming from or who it's coming from. And schools are making that adjustment too. And so, Tammy, to answer your question, and Kim has, but DHS has also been supportive too. And still have some work to do, but Anne, I wanted you to hear that.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Representative Snow.
Yeah, thanks, Dan. Dr. Meyer.
This is wonderful. And I personally have witnessed, for almost 35 years, I've provided clinic services at the Slate Canyon Juvenile Detention and seen this transition. The kids would talk to me, and they would, I couldn't believe, they'd say, "Why are you in here?" They would say, "Well, I ran away from my foster home." Or truancy, and then they're in foster home. And so this is a fabulous way to redirect more services to the homes they're in, because the parents benefit, the siblings benefit, all from this, not just the youths that are struggling. Very, very more cost-effective way to provide services.
Thank you.
Okay. Thank you.
just a quick comment. The data that we have for intergenerational poverty, just to make sure we've got it linked back, it's showing very similar that there's overlap between children experiencing intergenerational poverty and their involvement in juvenile justice. So just for the commission to know, we're always looking at data. We're intentional to make sure that we're talking about topics that are actually relevant to the population. This topic is very relevant. The one thing that I just want to ask very quickly is because poverty is a complex web of various issues, and we know that the kids have parents and they're in these families, I'm just curious if these evidence-based practices look at what's going on with the adults that are in the lives of the children.
That's part of the social history of the youth, and that establishes their risk level, right? That's their family history is a huge component, because the exposure that a child has and the support that a child has in the home is very indicative of usually what it's the source of the behavior. And so the social history, the family history, the school history is absolutely involved in the assessment to establish the risk level. Part of what we are doing with truancy to allow for more accountability for the youth and the family and for the schools to be more involved is that, so initially the kids would just go to court for truancy. With Health Bill 239, it says, well, you can't go to court at all for truancy, but there was a lot of pushback on that. And so we adjusted in House Bill 32, yeah. Representative Snow in House Bill 32 adjusted so that the schools can now refer some cases until 2020 to juvenile court, but they have to have a person from the school reach out to the family, have a person from the school work with the family and make all efforts and use an evidence-based practice and try to implement that before they can come to court. And then when they refer them to court, that person from the school and the youth and the family member also has to come to the referral to the court to see what other resources and programming might be available to them. So, and I agree, that's a huge issue. Another big issue is kids with parents who are incarcerated, right? That whole population within the school system, and there is a huge overlap. And so I'll try to connect with you later so that maybe we can talk a little bit about that. Yeah, thank you.
Let me also mention, follow up with what Dr. Miner said, is so one of the benefits of getting counseling or applying counseling resources to that young person is we're getting them to the home, to the family. And so it's not that incident becomes a catalyst for spreading that positive influence to the parents, because oftentimes what's happening with the young person is related to bigger issues that are happening with the parents or with siblings. And so Anne recognizes that. She's been very supportive. It's a good question. And the more we can put emphasis on families and supporting families, helping them, the better outcomes we're going to have.
I would add just one more thing. I agree. The peer support, I mean, getting into the household, family, and siblings is extremely important. The only thing I would add is also peer support within the school system. This is where I get my chance to pitch Good Behavior Game, where you actually create, as teachers teach math and English and art or music, they have Good Behavior Game instruction. I don't know if any of you looked it up or... But it's the kids watch out for each other and support each other. And sometimes that's also a very important way to connect with these kids. And you have to Google it. It's Good Behavior Games. The way instruction is given has tremendous, the savings are like to taxpayers and the public, like $64 return for every dollar invested. And you have 50% less suicide attempts, 50% less completed suicides. 12 years late after, kids have had this in first and second grade, this type of organ structure in the schools. So, try to look it up. And the Summit School District, North and South Summit School Districts, use it in their schools. So they started.
And that, I think, just goes hand in hand, really, with the philosophy of restorative practices, is that peer involvement, that community involvement, and holding each other accountable in the community. So,
Well, I just want to thank both, of course, Representative Snow, thank you for your involvement. Kim, thank you. We're so fortunate. I'm glad the rest of you get to see how great Kim is with CCJJ. I get to help pick judges with her, and she's fantastic. But this really is, as Tracy said, this aligns perfectly with what we're trying to accomplish. There's a reason that the juvenile justice was included on this commission, and it is because there is such a disparity, and when we look at the ties with those experiencing poverty, especially those in intergenerational poverty, and their involvement with the criminal justice system. And so as we're trying to do, the juvenile justice reform is trying to get further upstream. All of the data shows us that we can get further upstream, and especially when we're impacting youth, we have a chance to make a difference in their lives and save taxpayer dollars on all of the good stuff. But it's not easy. It's hard. And we have gone, that pendulum has swung too far the other way over time. I mean, you know, every kid in my school would have been locked up, including me, for some of the stuff we did when we were kids that now is seen as criminal behavior. And so I really appreciate that the changes that are happening, and appreciate that Tammy are educators who are taking on a heavier load.
It was a little tough at first, as Lowry knows.
And it's
the
hard.
Changes last year really helped.
We're asking our teachers and educators to do more than ever before, too, right? I mean, this all gets back, and I'll get off my soapbox, but it really gets back to community and what the changes that are happening from when we were kids and generational is that community is kind of crumbling a little bit. We don't have that same sense of community where we're all kind of raising each other's kids together, and the school is the one institution that is still there, where we kind of can come together, and that puts a tremendous burden on them. And so getting those extra resources really matters.
Super helpful.
And we need to do that. Okay, we're going to move into a section, and Lowry, we're going to start with you. I know you have a proposal that you would like to bring before the commission. Just as a reminder, historically, over the past few years, legislators who are running bills that align with what we're trying to do in this commission have come forward, presented their bills. We have an opportunity to vote if we want to support them. And John and I will, if the commission is in favor, we'll send a letter, kind of a standard letter, saying, hey, legislature, we, as you have asked us to do, as an intergenerational poverty reform commission, we review this. We think it aligns with our 5 and 10 year plan, and we're very supportive. That can be helpful, just giving a little stamp of approval and moving things forward. And we're happy to do that. We have three proposals today. We're going to hear from Representative Snow on some early childhood amendments, and then Ray Ward on school counseling, and then Representative Thurston on some earned income tax credits. So, Representative Snow.
Thank you. Thank you again, Mr. Chair. And you're absolutely right that as a lawmaker sponsoring legislation, it is very helpful, in my view, to have support of this body because, for many reasons. I know when I ran my extended kindergarten bill, getting that letter meant a great deal. I think I still have framed it on my wall. I'm especially grateful that I can present and talk a little bit about this bill. I hope we haven't used too much time, and I don't want to take too much time, but this is important legislation. I want to start out just somewhat for context. I want to highlight this study. Tracy, you've all seen this before. It was an amazing report, an amazing study, early childhood services study. And a part of this was devoted to early learning in our state of Utah and the need for quality instruction. One of the statistics, Tracy, that you pointed out was young children in Utah in the age group of 3 to 4 not enrolled in any kind of early learning, which included nursery, preschool, or kindergarten. That rate in Utah was 58%.
nationwide, 53%. The counter to that says, though, that about 42% in that age group was involved in Utah, and 47% nationwide. Now, the reason that I point that out is there are a lot of people who think that if you ask them how many of our young people are involved in early education, they might, coming from tradition, or what I would call traditional household, maybe say, well, 10, 15, 20%. But the reality is the demographics have changed significantly in our state, and they're going to continue to change, and a lot of it's related to the population moving in, but a lot of it's related to the times we live in where sometimes both parents are needing to work, and we have a lot of single-parent families that are required to work. There is a great need in our state, not just for help with the children during that period of time, but a great need for help by families to supplement early learning. So it was at least in part based, in my mind, on this study and some work that Senator Milner did, that in this last interim, Senator Milner and Representative Peterson, as chairing the education interim, appointed a study group, small study group, to look at early childhood learning in Utah and see what we could do with respect to creating a commission. And we were only one of, I think there's something like 31 or 32 states that have this kind of commission. Utah was not one of them. And the purpose of the commission, in my mind, isn't to promote universal childhood care. The purpose of the commission is to facilitate for parents that need this help access, and also to help with quality issues. And so the bill that is in front of you, or that I'm presenting, is House Bill 47, Early Childhood Coordination Amendment, that does two things. One, it establishes a commission under the governor's office, Tammy, and Lieutenant Governor chairing that commission. I heard you were a little light on work and needed to...
I had nothing to do.
And it is made up of department heads, a department head of Workforce Services, DHS, and also Department of Health. And it's a relatively small group. And it is supported by another body to be established that this does, and that's an advisory group that actually comes under the Department of Health. And all of the rules and makeup with respect to the advisory committee will come from them, and we'll have the input from professionals and others. This advisory group will make reports and recommendations to the commission. The commission, in turn, will make reports and recommendations to the legislature and to leadership of our state. I would tell you again, and it reinforces what I earlier said in terms of what the purpose of the commission, and the reason that I say this and emphasize this is I want it to be understood by our citizens that the duties of the commission, the very first duty that we outlined was, and I'm looking at line 146, supporting Utah parents and families. That's our number one objective. It isn't to take over or usurp what they do. It is to provide support. Who have family members that are in early childhood by providing comprehensive and accurate information regarding the availability of services that are available to children in early childhood from state agencies and other private and public entities. One of the things that Tracy Gruber taught us was that one of the great obstacles in getting parents access was lack of information, both where to go for these services, but also to help us grade the quality of those services. And we all know from the data that in order for early childhood learning experience to be helpful and effective, it's got to be of a certain quality. So one of the things the commission is going to help us do is have that standard of quality and help us assess that and encourage training so that it's not just about getting young people to daycare, but those that are enrolled with the idea that it's an early learning experience will have that kind of quality help. So the purpose of the bill is to establish those two bodies and their duties and the outcomes that we expect from them are outlined in the legislation. And again, its primary emphasis is to support families and their needs across our state. So, thank you, Mr. Chair.
Any questions? You'll see in your packet there we have one sheet, well, one and a half sheets that has a summary of the proposal and how it aligns with our commission goals. We've reviewed it, staff has reviewed it as well, and has given us a recommendation of support. I want to thank you again, Senator Still, thank you for your work on this, Senator Milner as well. Tammy's been very involved in...
shout out to Bruce Cutler, who
Bruce
did
Cutler.
A lot of...
Yes,
lot
he
of
has, yeah. and should be mentioned, yes.
Yeah, most of you probably know, Representative Cutler has been working on this, did not get reelected, but he sent his regards and support for this as well. I'm also very supportive. Early childhood education is something that is near and dear to me. As many of you know, my wife Abby had a degree in special education with an emphasis in early childhood sphere, and spent a lot of time learning as she was in homes with early intervention and seeing the big impact that it makes in lives and helping families get out of that cycle of poverty. So,
can I just make one other comment? In a lot of states, they call this their children's cabinet, which indicates the importance that they place on this very issue, and so I'm very excited about the bill.
Yeah, thank you. Any questions, concerns, thoughts? I will open it up then for a motion of support or opposition as you see fit.
I move we support this legislation.
Thank you, Dr. Miner. Is there a second?
Second.
Thank you. All in favor, please say aye.
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 And any opposed? Okay, the motion carries unanimously.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you all very much.
We will get that letter drafted and out to you, and don't feel obligated to stay if you have other things that you
well,
can.
We'll probably slip out.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you
very much. So thank you both of you. Okay, next on the agenda, we'll roll right in to Representative Ray Ward, who has a proposal around student and school, the title of the legislation is Student and School Safety Assessment, and this has to do with counseling. Is he,
we may need to jump to...
We're trying to figure out if he's on.
Okay.
If not, then Representative Thurston. He was going to call in because he was having technical problems.
Okay. And Representative Ward, are you on by chance? All right. Let's push pause on that one, and we'll move on to the next one, which is Representative Thurston, who is working on an issue involving college savings through the EITC. Thank you so much again for joining us, Representative Thurston. We have your materials here in front of us. And actually, I don't think we have a draft bill on this one, right? Yet. So this is more of a kind of pitching the idea, and we won't take a formal vote today until we see the legislation, but we want to give people prep for this one. So please, go ahead.
Okay. So I'm not able to see your screen there. PowerPoint?
We don't have a PowerPoint. We are just seeing you.
Okay, sorry.
I can turn the PowerPoint on now.
We have a hard copy.
Oh, okay.
In front
I'll turn it on now.
All right.
So go ahead, Representative.
Okay.
And we'll get that pulled up while you're talking.
Yeah, so I'm just going to hit the beginning stuff is the first couple of slides I think are not news to you. Obviously, you know about the intergenerational poverty efforts and issues. That's you, so you know that. But one of the things that I've been noticing is that there's an interest in helping intergenerational poverty families by doing lots of different things. But when it comes down to my personal view, the whole goal of our effort is to break the cycle. Sure, they have immediate needs, and those need to be addressed. They have immediate medical needs, immediate financial needs, housing, food, whatever. But the goal of the intergenerational poverty effort is not to meet immediate needs, it's to break the cycle. And the way that I think, and from what I've been able to read from your reports, which are very helpful, by the way, that we do that is that we need to motivate changes in behavior that are known to end poverty, to break that cycle, such as improving job skills, getting kids into education and career training, getting people back to work, asset development, and so forth. So this summer, there had been a proposal come up to one of the interim committees regarding the Earned Income Tax Credit, which has been around for several years. And the idea was to focus that on the intergenerational poverty families. So, so we can go ahead about three slides. That'd be great. One, two, right there. Okay. So, so the question then was, well, if we're going to give families an earned income tax credit, we could do that. And if we're going to limit it to only intergenerational poverty families, we could do that too. But at the end of the day, are we going to use that money, that money, to break the poverty cycle, or are we just going to be giving people money? And so the proposal that came to us is, well, we just give them money. And the justification was, well, they have needs. You know, they have children in school, they need to buy shoes, they have needs, so let's just give them money. And I got thinking, I was like, well, no, let's go back and look at all of the work that you have done and these areas of emphasis and see if we can target that credit to specific behavioral changes that are known and shown based on data and evidence to break the poverty cycle. So the areas of emphasis I looked at were the same four that you have: early childhood development, education, health, and family economic stability. And it seems to me that the Earned Income Tax Credit would be most applicable to that fourth category of family economic stability. So let's go ahead and go to the next slide. And when it comes to that sector, what do we know that works? What is the evidence? What are the studies showing? The first thing we know is that 63% of the adults of the IGP families are already working. So we've got a leg up. We've got families that are already working, and they qualify for the federal Earned Income Tax Credit. So that's good. That's a good thing. But we also know that not everybody who is eligible applies for and receives that Earned Income Tax Credit. The average federal Earned Income Tax Credit is around $3,000, and that's free federal money that's sitting there to help those families for whatever they need. And so one behavioral change that we ought to look at is, why are these families not applying for the federal income tax credit already available for them? Another thing that we know is that saving for education has a huge impact on those children's decision to seek career training. There's solid evidence that if you just open a 529 plan, that dramatically increases the child's likelihood of graduating from high school and going on to some sort of post-secondary training. So using those two things, what I want to put together is a proposal that if we're going to do an earned income tax credit, let's focus on giving these families a guided hand up that's more than just a handout, more than just giving them cash. Let's focus on those behavior changes that really matter. Let's take a look at the next slide. So here's the proposal. It's actually quite simple. This is what I would propose that we would do. There are three qualifications. Really, the third one's not a qualification. It's an aspiration. But the first two are what the basis of the program is. In order to get the state earned income tax credit, you must do two things. One, you have to apply for and receive the federal earned income tax credit. So you'd think that people would just know to do that on their own, but this would maybe nudge them, give them a little bit more of a nudge to do that one. And the second thing, open up and fund a 529 education savings plan. Again, you think that they should know to do that, but some people just don't. They don't know. They don't think about it. They don't do it. And so this would nudge them in that direction. And, of course, it would be ideal if they received financial counseling, but I don't have a good way of creating a system and paying for a system to support the family. So that might be something that we have to work on in the future. So the next slide is, here's what happens. All of the earned income tax credit money that we have available is money that comes out of the education fund. So logically, if we're going to give somebody an earned income tax credit, and if we're going to be at least true to the spirit of the Constitution that says education fund money must be used for educational purposes, that money ought to stay in a restricted account somehow that's going to benefit education. So what I would propose is that the state EITC funds that we give them are given not as just a check, not as just a here's cash in your pocket, but we give it as restricted matching funds that get deposited into their 529 plan to benefit their children and encourage them to go to college or to training programs further down the road. And then we limit that money so that it can only be used for qualified education expenses. And that helps us frame what it is that we're really trying to focus on here. We're trying to help families develop assets, but what are we really trying to do? We're really trying to get that next generation motivated to go get career training and to get the job that's going to lead them out of poverty. So I think there's one more slide. And this obviously is part of a broader effort, could be part of a broader effort, which I'm calling your holistic approach. And I looked through recommendations and things that we've done in the past that have come out of your group. This works nicely with many of those. For example, it works nicely with the idea of providing additional scholarship funding for these kids to participate in two-year career training. So some variation of that, and there have been several proposals on that one. We also have recently passed the idea that there could be private corporate donations into 529 plans. So a family could use those private donations as the seed money to get state matching funds. We've also talked about funding for two-year career training to recruit and advise these students to help them get into these two-year programs. The child tax credit that we worked on last year, that we have probably more work to do. Same thing, that motivates families to file the state tax return, gives us an opportunity to reach out. And then we've got the VA assistance for tax filing. And the last one that I don't think you understand well enough, but I'll look at more, is work opportunity and tax credit. All of these things work together to get those kids ready as they're progressing through their public education programs, get them ready and excited about moving on to a next generation educational system. So I do have one more thing that I forgot about. I'll go ahead and do that last point. This is easily measurable. We can see if there's a meaningful increase in asset development. We can look at the 529 savings plans. We know who the families are, we know which ones have 529 savings plans and which ones don't, and we can look at the balance over time and see if it's helped develop assets. It also allows us to measure easily what percent of eligible votes are in the federal EITC. So we can look at that one. We can also look at the long-run increase in participation in career training programs. Are these kids actually getting to college? Or are they getting into technical programs? Or are they getting into some form of career training program? Over the long run, we can see if that works. There is some theory out there that this leads to an increase in work effort. But looking at the literature, the amount of money that we're talking about don't really seem to be there. I mean, it's hard to imagine that if a family is going to get an extra $250 or $300 next year, that's going to be enough to motivate them to go get an extra job or to increase their work hours or something like that. If they're going to be motivated to do those things, that isn't going to be enough money to do that. But I do think it's enough money to motivate those kids to go to training programs and enough money to pay for the semester. That's going to really help, and that's going to move them along. So that's the proposal. The idea would be that if the state policy is funded to have an earned income tax credit, let's target it with behaviors that really are going to matter to break the cycle of poverty instead of just handing out checks. So that's the proposal in a nutshell, and I'm happy to take any questions.
Thank you, Representative. Very, very thorough, very well done, and fascinating. Any questions for Representative Thurston? Representative, we'll ask you to, as soon as you have a draft bill, to get it out to us, so we can make a formal a decision as a group. Have you had a chance to share this concept with your colleagues? I know we've had some EITC legislation in the past. This is definitely a different take on it, and I think a take that will probably help it gain traction in the body. But what are you seeing so far?
Yeah, I think you're right. We discussed in the Education and Workforce Development Interim Committee briefly, and then Representative Robert has been helping on this one. We presented it in I think it might have been Revenue Taxation, and I think you're right. I think it helps the idea get traction. It's real. It's not just a tax spend. It's a program that has a purpose, and the purpose is to help break that cycle of poverty. And I think that it has much broader appeal to colleagues across the spectrum. You have that specific purpose. Why are we spending? Oh, this could be $5 million, which is not change. But we need to say, let's target that to the population where we're really making a difference. I think it's going to help.
Yeah, I agree. So. Okay, yeah, please.
The folks that administer the 529 account, are they supportive? Representative, you talk to them. I know this will be an administrative cost to them and some work on their end. Are they okay? Or?
I don't know that I could support any legislative proposal. But in discussing with Ward and her staff, they're excited about the idea of encouraging more people to open up the 529 plan. And we think we've worked on the practical aspect of how it would be done. And it's not that hard, at least not from the 529 plan perspective. The Tax Commission has a little more work as well. I put them in today. I think we're okay there. And we just got to go with our services to make sure we all work together. But I think it can be done.
Very cool. Anything else? All right. We wish you the very best, representative. We'll look forward to seeing a draft legislation.
Okay. I am hoping for one too.
Okay. Thank you.
All right. Thanks. Bye bye.
All right. Okay. We now have Representative Ward on the phone. Welcome, Representative Ward.
Thank you so much for having me.
We're excited to have you. We're ready for you now. Members of the commission should have the summary in front of you from your bill titled Student and School Safety Assessment, focusing on as part of our four pillars, education and health. So the floor is now yours, Representative Ward. Thank you.
Thank you so much. So this bill kind of has its genesis toward the end of last session when the Parkland shooting occurred in Florida. And there was very understandably national soul searching about what all the companies and schools think. And there was some cry for the legislation to do something right away, but it was a very big issue, and we are towards the end of the session. So at the end of the session, the Utah State Schools Commission was put together, and we met over the course of last spring with a bunch of expertise from all different walks of our school system and public safety system, and that commission made its recommendations in June, and its top recommendation was then the genesis for this bill, that we do better at having school safety, threat assessment and school student safety assessment teams in our schools. This bill is modeled after a very successful program in Virginia, where it was implemented, and as the program was implemented in Virginia, it kind of had something that doesn't happen very often. It was implemented in part of the state and not the rest of the state, and so it gave a 3 or 4 year window for several different scientific medical research groups to come in and study whether it was making a difference. We don't get that very often. And on several different studies, it was found to make important improvements. So as a result, this kind of a program is one of the only ones that actually has SAMHSA, Substance Abuse and Mental Health Administration, stamp of approval where they feel like it's an intervention that has evidence to improve student and school safety. They found decreased amounts of bullying. They found decrease in long-term suspension, all while keeping the schools safe. Where they, in all the threat assessments they did during the time they assessed it, there fortunately weren't any death or serious injury in their school. So they gave this recommendation, and we have had our leadership here, folks in the governor's office and folks from our state office of education, been involved in drafting this bill and in speaking with the program in Virginia to see what was successful for them. The bill really, which done as of yesterday, even now I have a bill number, so that's good. It's HB 120. And it really has two parts in it that work together. So one part is that to have the schools will establish threat assessment teams that may be similar to what many schools on the lot that Trent already have in place to respond to a threat. But it pairs that together with a safety program, a threat assessment program in the State Office of Education, so that we have a hub in the middle where best practice is kept close track of and that information has gotten out to schools, where schools have a place to report what's happening into a central hub so that if things are doing better or worse, we actually know what's working and how it's going. One example of a best practice that this will help put in place that we don't have in place uniformly across the state right now is with our SROs. So we have SROs in many of our schools, but in some schools they are hired just straight out of post, and so now there's law enforcement officers on our school campus. And really, when we have law enforcement on our school campuses, we want quite a few things from them that are not the same as we want from regular law enforcement. There's extra rules that they need to abide by. There's extra ways that the intervention can be done, some of which might be damaging to a student, others of which would be helpful, and we want to be mindful of that. So one of the things this bill will do is help that each school district get the memorandum of understanding in place so that those SROs get adequate training and can make sure that they're behaving in a way that helps all of our students succeed. So together with that program, then, we we do just need an increase in personnel that helps with this. And that could be many different kinds of personnel. It can be additional SRO support, but perhaps more importantly, it's mental health support, it's social work support. And so the bill has a sizable fiscal note. It's a $30 million ongoing task specifically for personnel related to school safety. And that money will be passed through to the state office, who will then distribute it out. It's not a grant program. It will just be distributed out to the schools, but it must be spent on personnel that relates to school safety. And then there is a one-time ask, not for personnel, but for things that are related to school safety, because there are also many other things, not people, that the schools do need, but we wanted to leave it up to the schools to decide what they most needed. So that could be an upgrade to their entryway to make it a single point of entry into a school, or to install an intercom system in the entryway, or to install different software in the classrooms that relate to school safety. There's a long list of things the schools may want. This bill has been a great collaborative effort, working together with the state office and the governor's team and the school superintendent. And I think it really does, the students who I think are going to benefit from this the most are the schools, the students who are on the struggling end of being in our school system, where they may be the ones who are bullied, they may be the ones who are the bullies. Either way, we want to be there and help them out and have them come to a successful conclusion of their experience in our schools while keeping our students safe from violence from others and keeping our students safe from violence against themselves, from suicide and the other things that go along with depression. So that's about what I have to tell you, but I'd be very happy to answer any questions.
Okay. Thank you very much. Questions? Please.
I have a question. Representative Ward, this is Joe Minor from the commission here.
Yes.
As you know, there are also school nursing shortages, and school nurses frequently are asked by school districts to be involved in student behaviors and mental health issues. Would school nurses, especially if they've had some continuing education in behavioral health issues, also be able to be funded from this if that were the school district's preference? Or
yes,
some combination? That's what I
so the language? Yes, it would. So the language just says that it is personnel related to student safety. So it could be a school nurse, that could be a social worker, but it leaves the determination of what is most important up to the schools themselves, rather than the state trying to say that this is the person that you need the most. The amount of money that it is, when we say $30 million ongoing, another way to think about that is that it's about a half a person per school in the state.
Yes, very good. I know that, for example, Utah County Health Department provides the school nursing for the three school districts there, and currently they average like one-fifth of a nurse per school. Most nurses will cover about five or six schools, so they have a shortage there also. I know Dr. Bill Cosgrove has advocated that they also be involved in behavioral health, like they frequently are asked anyway. So that would be a pitch for that. And it sounds like they would be able to take.
Yeah, our school nurses are spread very thin, and I think the case is right now that we don't even intend that they be an on-the-site medical provider who's there the whole time the school is in session. We're not anywhere close to that. So each school district just needs to figure out what set of tasks is the highest priority and what is reasonable that some increase in personnel could, what extra things could we provide. But there's a long list of things that we could be providing to our students that would give a better attitude and atmosphere in the school to head off mental health problems early before they turn into something that's dangerous to the student or even worse, to students. Violence against others.
Excellent, yeah.
Thank you. Any other questions? I would note that that funding for this is included in the governor's budget, mm-hmm. So we are very supportive from the executive branch on this approach, and something that the governor's been really adamant about for a long time, that we need increased resources for behavioral health and counseling in schools to help students out, and again aligns very well with our 5 to 10 year goals. With that, if there are no other questions, I would entertain a motion to either support or oppose the Representative Ward's bill.
I'll make a motion to support the draft of House Bill 120.
Thank you.
I second it.
We have a motion and a second. All in favor, please say aye.
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 And any opposed? All right. Hearing none, the motion carries unanimously. Thank you, Representative Ward, for your time. We will get a letter out to you showing the support of the commission.
Thank you so much. Thank you for all your work on this.
You're welcome.
Letting me participate today.
Have a great day. Thank you.
I surely will. Bye-bye.
All right. Last but certainly not least, I am excited to have Tammy Piper here. Any excuse to get her out of the office.
That's right.
Good one.
Get her out, period. The governor paid him off when he does this, so.
Tammy is, we thought it would be good to just update the members of the commission on the governor's proposed budget, and not the whole proposed budget, not all $19 billion, but specifically the portions of the budget that relate to what we're doing here with intergenerational poverty and specifically on the education front. And Tammy, for I think all of you know, is the governor's education advisor. She's fantastic. I've had the opportunity to work with her now for 5 years since she joined our team. And Tammy,
Okay. Before I dive into this, I wanted to follow up really quickly on Ray Ward's bill, because you will see another bill from Steve Ellison that addresses the same thing, and they both know that we are supportive of both of their bills. As the legislative process happens to be, there can be several bills that are trying to address the same issue. And as the governor's budget came out, we just want there to be $31 million for counseling, and we intentionally we want that to cover school nurses, because as of, I think it was last year, school nurses have to have continuing education now in crisis management and some mental health issues. So it could be school nurses, social workers, psychologists. It could be a psychiatrist. It could be contracting with a local mental health agency. We just want that money there. So whether Representative Ward's bill is the one that rises to the top, we've helped draft that, actually, Karen Peterson and I. Steve Ellison is going to make changes to his elementary school counseling bill and make it K-12 and have it include the same people. His will have some different nuances. I think his might require a match. We just want the money to go there, match or no match. And so you'll see both of those bills work their way up. I just don't want you to be confused that we are prioritizing one or the other. We're supporting both of them as long as it gets this money into schools. So with that said, I just wanted to, for those of you that haven't seen the education roadmap, the governor, when he builds an education budget, we look at what our strategy is and our strategies that are included in the education roadmap. And I wanted to point out for you what some of those strategies are that we determined as we built this roadmap, and then tell you how that's being addressed in the budget. We have four main areas of focus in the governor's education roadmap. And those are ensuring early learning, supporting teachers, supporting and strengthening educators, ensuring access and equity, and completing certificates and degrees. For those of you not familiar with the Governor's Education Excellence Commission, the inside of this front cover tells you who was involved in developing this roadmap, this plan. So in these areas that are strategies that we've discussed for the last 2 to 3 years, the governor's budget covers specific areas of that budget. I'm going to highlight for you a couple of them. School counseling, which we've just talked about. If you look in the governor's education roadmap on page 9, that's one of the first strategies that we have for strengthening and supporting educators, is giving them the support personnel that they need to address those things that students need. As Lieutenant Governor mentioned, schools are being asked to do more, and teachers are being asked to be everything for everyone. And a lot of times teachers will say, more money for a salary is fine. What I really like is more time and more support for my students. I'd love to have a social worker at our school. I would love to be able to send some kids for counseling because they will perform better in the classroom, and I can teach them if those basic needs are met. So in the governor's budget, on this separate handout, fourth from the top, school counseling, we've put in $31.7 million for school counseling. The next item on this list that you have, add-on for students at risk of academic failure. Last year in the governor's budget, we added, I think it was $10 million to that existing line item. It's called Enhancement for At-Risk Students. Kim Cordova talked about that. It's money that is flexible to some degree. We made it more flexible last year to help pay for some of the juvenile justice reform efforts. But that's a way for us to get to students in intergenerational poverty families. So we added money last year. We're asking for another $15.2 million this year to add to those existing funds. That would bring it up to about $70 million, I believe, $65-$70, that we have put together over just the last few years to help students who are at risk. And that goes in that EARS line item. What that money can pay for are things like you will find in the education roadmap under ensuring early learning. Schools can use that money in their preschool programs, their four-year-old preschool programs that are happening in the school. If those are students who are at risk, that they can determine. We've tried to make the definitions flexible enough that they can, as a school, use those funds for students who are at risk. They use Title I funds now, and they could be used as a supplement to that. We also are looking at a new WPU add-on, back to this sheet of the governor's budget, for students who are in rural Utah. A lot of times, those are the students that I know that the IGP Commission is focusing on, and we have funding for students who are in necessarily existent small schools, the NEST funding. This funding would go beyond the NEST funding to students who are in the rural school setting. So it broadens what we're able to do for those students. And that would address issues that you see and that you're addressing on your commission. We will be seeing some new money coming in from the property tax revenue. That's the second section here in the governor's budget. And so we've labeled it flexible allocation. About $18.7 million of new funds will be coming in because last year they voted to freeze the basic rate, the basic property rate. So instead of having that rate drop every year, which keeps the fundings consistently about the same, they froze that rate. So as property values increase, funds will increase. We anticipate about $18.7 million coming in through that. Those monies can be used for local priorities. And as we're hearing time and time again, everywhere we go, one of those priorities is counseling, is more counselors, social workers, and school nurses. We hear that quite a bit, Dr. Miner. And so that's more money coming into the schools. The other item, which is right below that, the equity pupil unit, that's another funding mechanism that the legislature has worked on the last 2 years. This helps districts. Many of them are rural, but some of them are districts like Alpine and Alpine District, who they can raise property taxes, but because the property valuations are lower than average, they don't really get anywhere. And so this equity pupil unit is an additional add-on that helps with that. One last thing I want to talk about. Two last things I want to talk about. If you flip this page over, this is in higher education. And in the governor's education roadmap on page 12, we talk about ensuring access and equity. Through the governor's budget, one of the ways that we are trying to increase equity for students that have intergenerational poverty issues, I'm going to say IGP, or just our low-income families, access to higher education is very, very difficult. And so the governor has proposed putting $50 million into an endowment to provide scholarship for students based on need. And in order to get the students that we need and get those students to college, we are putting in $6 million in a college advising corps. These are These are near peer advisors, so these are recently graduated university students who will go into high schools. The goal is to have one in every high school. This is not the school counselor. This isn't the scholarship counselor that some schools have enough funding to have. This is a student, a near peer counselor who is there specifically to help students get to a technical college or one of our USHE institutions. They help them through the application process. They help them through the FAFSA process. They help students with any questions that they have. And between that and our $50 million endowment, we're hoping to reach more of our students who typically would not consider going to college or just really not have the resources to go to college. And those are the areas that we're addressing for both the Ensure Access and Equity and Complete Certificates and Degrees. And there are strategies that were called out specifically in this roadmap. And I've been checking off. Now, this is our second year of using the roadmap, and we've been using this as a roadmap. And I'm checking off strategies that we've proposed and those that were passed last year. We've put done, stamped done on. The governor really operates that way. He wants to see the plan. He wants to see what we're doing on the plan, and he wants to check off what we were able to accomplish. And so that's what we've been doing with this. Can I take a point of personal privilege?
You can.
And I'm going to try and do this without getting emotional, but education is so important into pulling people out of poverty. I've always known that. I recently learned, though, that this person that I deeply admire to the point of on a pedestal, her name's Terrell Warner. She took my place on the State Board of Education in Cache Valley. And when you leave a position, you want to leave it better than you found it. So I recruited her and said, Terrell, you've got to take my place. You're going to be fantastic. She went through the interview process. The governor agreed that Terrell would be fantastic. Terrell has been engaged as a victims advocate in Cache Valley, and she is a problem solver. And I want to tell you about two of the things that she's done working with people in poverty and people in intergenerational poverty, people that are at risk. And this is just Terrell's personal, this is just her. These are her ideas. One of the most recent programs that she has implemented in Cache County is with offenders, people that are criminally adjudicated. And she said, the judge usually says, I need you to get your GED. And that sometimes happens and sometimes doesn't. Sometimes they prefer to go to jail. Well, she has implemented a new program just this last year that rather than saying you have to get a GED, instead of going to jail, if they will take classes at Bridgerland Tech College, and if they will get a certificate and some skill, they will be, that is their, I don't know what you call it, but that's their...
They're
plain abeyance. That's what they get instead of having to go to jail or pay a fine. And along with that, they have to agree to get a certificate, and they have to agree that their children will, if they have children, that they will not miss school, and they will check so that there will be no absences, and then they have to check in with their officer. She recently had one of the individuals last year call her and say, hey, Cheryl, I wanted to let you know that I'm doing really well. He completed a six-month program. He said, I love this job. Thank you for making this, available for me. He said, I just kind of wanted to let you know I did a little looking up online, and I make more money than you do. And she said, I've never been more happy to hear that someone made more money than I do. She had another woman who was picked up, and this is just so sad to me. She was picked up for shoplifting. She was in Desert Industry, and she was switching tags from a 50-cent item to a $3 item because she couldn't afford it. She was picked up for shoplifting. She was referred. So she went through the phlebotomist program. And within, I believe it was 3 to 6 weeks, finished the program, got a job, was able to move out of her parents' home, get an apartment, and start taking additional classes. Her life changed almost overnight because of education. Terrell said that they've had 17 people go through this program the first year, and they estimate that they've saved about $50,000 in supervision, parole, that kind of thing. The other program is just one that Terrell's done on her own. She and her husband were assigned to work with Latino youth in their church. And they were just supposed to be mentors. And they were in charge of the weekly church activity. She says, we didn't do church activities. She said, we brought a crock pot of food, and we worked with them on ACT prep. We worked with them on homework. We looked at their last assignment. We worked with them on missing assignments. We went with their parents to parent-teacher conference. We translated for them. She said, we came into a group of students that hadn't had someone graduate from that congregation, graduate from high school for years. In the 7 years that they've been there, there have been zero teen pregnancies. Every student but one has graduated from high school. Several have graduated from college. Several are working on applications for grad school. Again, what did they do? It was completely focused on education. The reason that, I'm so sorry, I'm usually not so verklempt. Terrell, I recently learned from a conversation, Terrell and her husband both came from homes of poverty. Terrell's was intergenerational poverty, pretty severe poverty. She and her husband were the first college graduates from their family, and the first one, and still the only ones in their families that have escaped poverty. And she's credited that to her education, and she's turned around, and not only through the programs I've described, but the victim advocacy work that she has done. I could be here all day telling you whose lives she has changed. So my point being,